Hi guys, how you doing? I hope everybody's doing great. As you already know, we have been progressing together in our classes, and now we are making together this which we call community. And I hope everybody is finding yourself with the energy, blissfulness, and words of encouragement that make you feel the person that you must want to be in your life. As of today, guys, I was recording, just so you know, I was recording this, and all of a sudden, my phone turned off, and I lost progress of the first chapter of the book. However, that's very good, because that puts me in a position where I can give you a little introduction about what this book talks about and why we decided to do this book together. As you already know, you voted for this book, and now I bring it to you, right? The book is by one of my precious mentors, a big person to me, and a profound thinking, right? Alan Watts, right, is the best known as interpreter of Zen Buddhism, in a particular, of Indian and Chinese philosophy in general. He earned the reputation of being one of the most original and unfettered philosophers of the 20th century. He was the author of more than 20 books, including The Way of Zen, The Wisdom of Insecurity, Does It Matter? Psychotherapy East and West, The Book, This Is It, and many others. Great person, great profound, as you can find his information and everything about him on YouTube too, okay? And you can see the way he talks and the way how he tries to give us a sense of self-understanding. So without further ado, we'll get started, and I hope you guys enjoy it. This is called the Define for Happiness, right? How to find true happiness. Well, it has been said that the more you look for happiness, the further away you are from it, right? Therefore, that those who search for happiness never find it. Probably, perhaps the truth is that there is no need to search for it. Like our own eyes, it may be going along with us all the time. Only when we turn round to try to see it, we make fools for ourselves. I'm going to start with this precious Chinese poem that says, "It is so clear that it takes long to see. You must know that the fire which you are seeking, it is the fire in your own lantern, and that your rice has been cooked from the very beginning. Don't look for it. Instead, enjoy it, and let's see what Mr. Alan Watts has to say for how to find our true self and happiness within ourselves." Without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. Chapter number one, The Way of Happiness. War in the Soul. Almost everyone knows the story of the goose that laid the golden eggs. A man and his wife had a mysterious goose that from time to time favored them by laying a golden egg. When this had been going on for some weeks, they began to think it rather tiresome of this goose to part with its gold so gradually, for they imagined that it carried a store of such eggs inside itself. Not having the sense to weigh the creature first and find out if it was much heavier than a goose should be, they decided to kill it and cut it open. As might be expected, they found only one ordinary dead goose, void of gold eggs and unable to produce any more. There were once scientists, too, who were similarly disappointed when they searched the human anatomy to find an organ that might be described as the soul. There are still scholars who analyze Beethoven down to the last semiquaver and Shakespeare to the last pronoun to find the secret of their genius. And there are also theologians who do much the same thing with the words of the Bible to discover the nature of God. And it is yet the hope of even the most advanced science that the universe will yield up its mysteries, its last mighty secret, to those who dissect its tiniest fragments, learning more and more about less and less. This is known as not being able to see the wood for the trees. It is by no means an error peculiar to scientists and scholars, for the fable of the golden egg is an ancient tale of human nature. We have a saying about the virtue of being able to see life whole, for all meaning is in wholeness. There could be no golden eggs without the goose, and however tiresome, slow, and stupid the goose might be, he resembled life in that he was an interplay of opposites. He was slow, but his eggs were gold. And if you cut him to pieces to gather the gold and discard the slowness, you were left with nothing but a corpse. This will also happen if you carve up the human body to find the mysterious source of its vitality, or if you separate the flower of a plant from its muddy roots. Something very similar happens in a much more important way when men love life and hate death, or cling to youth and reject old age, which is like expecting a mountain to have only one slope, that which goes up, whereas to be a mountain, it must go up and down. For the meaning is in the whole, and not only the meaning, but the very existence of the thing. Indeed, we are only aware of life, and life is only able to manifest itself because it is divided into innumerable pairs of opposites. We know motion by contrast with stillness, long by short, light by darkness, heat by cold, and joy by sorrow. Therefore, to see life whole is to understand these opposing qualities as essential to its existence, without trying to interfere, without dissecting the body of the universe, so that its pleasant portions may be preserved and its unpleasant cast away. This is why the philosophic Hindu understands when looking at the most terrible things, we can say, Sarvanam Kalvidam Brahman, this too is Brahman. That divine being of whole self, each single thing is a changing aspect. And to him, this Brahman is not merely the whole universe, any more than seeing life whole is seeing the whole of life. In this sense, Brahman is rather the wholeness, even the holiness of life, which can be destroyed only in the fantasy world of our minds. Therefore, those who attempt to destroy it carry, as it were, corpses in their thoughts, which corrupt and poison their souls. In the life to which they cling in horror of death, the pleasure in fear of pain, the wealth in fear of poverty, and the youth in fear of age. I'll repeat this one more time. The pleasure in fear of pain, the wealth in fear of poverty, and the youth in fear of age. They hold only to the world's dismembered limbs. Yet, though they made known it, the dismembering and the consequent suffering exists only in themselves. They think they can take the whole apart, but it's a poor illusion. Its only result is that for all their clinging their life, pleasure, wealth, money, material things, and youth have the taint of unhappiness, because having cut them off to possess them forever, they're no more alive. Thus, it is not surprising that some few wise ones, having come to grief in this way, cry out that pleasure and wealth are sins, wherein no happiness is to be found. But fire is not evil, because it burns your fingers. If you try to catch hold of it, it is only dangerous. The problem of opposites. We call such things as life and death opposites. But this is not altogether a satisfactory name, seeing that it implies a state of opposition and hence of conflict. But life and death are in conflict only in the mind, which creates a war between them out of its own desires and fears. In fact, life and death are not opposed, but complementary. Being the two essential factors of a greater life that is made up of living and dying, just as melody is produced by the sounding and silencing of individual notes. Life feeds on death. Its very movement is only possible and apparent because of the continuous birth and death of cells. The absorption of nourishment and the discarding of waste, which in turn provides a fertile soil from which new life can spring. For vitality is a cycle whose completion requires both upward movement and downward movement, just as light cannot manifest itself without the whole motion of the light wave from start to finish. If these waves could be divided into half or quarter waves, the light would disappear. So also in the biological realm, we have two opposite yet complementary sexes, male and female. Beings are divided in this way in order to reproduce themselves. And the meaning of man and woman is the child, without which there would be no point in having two sexes at all. Thus, they are the two legs upon which our life stands. And when one is cut away, the whole collapses. These so-called opposites present man with a difficult problem, for there is a longing in his heart for eternity and victory over death, a longing which is misdirected because in life, as he knows it, he himself is one of those opposites, and thus is apparently set against something over which he can never triumph. For the foundation of our life, as we know it, it is the opposition between ourselves and the universe. Between that which is I and that which is not I. Here, again, are two things which are complementary rather than opposed. For it's obvious that the self cannot exist without the universe, and the universe cannot exist without the multitude of selves and entities of which it's composed. But from the point of view of suffering, struggling men, this fact, however obvious, is purely abstract. Moreover, the existence of the universe depends apparently only on the impersonal multitude of selves, of which there is an inexhaustible supply. It does not depend on any particular self. Indeed, nature seems astonishingly and wasteful in its treatment of individual self, and is therefore not surprised that man should rebel when treated with the same disregard for individuality as is the insects. It even seems that here there is an actual conflict which does not exist solely in the mind, for with one hand nature lavishes the most amazing skill on the creation of individuals and even on their preservation, while with the other it treats them as if they were no more than the dust from which they rose. But if one or the other's nature hands were tied, the world would either choke itself from overabundance of life or be altogether depopulated. Nevertheless, from the individual point of view, the process is wasteful and callous. Men might assist nature to a great economy by regulating the reproduction of his own kind, by adapting himself to nature instead of trying to fight it. But this requires a concerted social effort that might take thousands of years to accomplish, and hence is of little consequence to individuals living in the turmoil of the 20th century. However, scientific measures for the removal of suffering are here besides the point, for it's doubtful whether the resulting increase of comfort would be welcome if it were sufficient to upset the balance of the opposites. Just as too much light blinds the eyes, too much pleasure numbs the senses. To the apparent, it needs contrast. But the problem of man's conflict with the universe remains. We can present any numbers of straightforward rational solutions justifying the existence of these uncomfortable opposites and the unfortunate but necessary operations of natural law. It is the easiest thing in the world to philosophize, telling man how glad he should be that he suffers, seeing that otherwise he would be unable to feel joy. But when it comes to the point, such talk is found to be remote and abstract, leaving the heart unconvinced even if the head is satisfied. For here we are touching the very root of man's unhappiness, and to these regions the sweetly reasonable voice of purely philosophy does not penetrate. Whatever may be said about the need of basing one's attitude to life on a universal and distinct from a personal point of view, the difficulty is that in the ordinary way, man does not feel universal. His center is himself, and his consciousness peeps out through windows in a wall of flesh. He does not feel his consciousness as existing in things outside of himself, seeing through others, eyes or moving with others, limbs. And the world outside that wall is threatening, so much so that he does everything possible to fortify himself against it. Surrounding himself with a barricade of possessions and illusions to hide himself from the world and the world from him, within this fortress, he strives to guard and preserve the thing he calls his life. But he might as well try to imprison sunlight in a room by pulling down the blind or trap wind by shutting the door. To enjoy the wind, you must let it blow, past you and filled against. The same is true of time, for the moment has always gone before it can be seized. And the same is true of life, which not even this wall of flesh can hold forever. To feel and understand it, you must let it blow past you like the wind, and it moves across the earth from boy to boy. But this is intolerable. It means tearing down the barricade, giving up every security, opening windows both sides of the room so that the draft sweeps through, knocks down the vases, scatters out papers, and upsets the furniture. This is too great a price to pay for having the dust and the prices of our souls. Besides, we shall catch cold and sit shivering and sneezing till we go crazy. So we keep the windows closed and shutter until we die from suffocation, overwhelmed by stagnant air. Wow, these are very, very advanced vocabulary, guys. If you're not understanding the whole point of this, what I'm going to do at the end of every single chapter I read, I will give you my own opinion so you guys have an idea what this guy is talking about. So he's using a very advanced way of speaking. He speaks like in poems. So as far as I understood, he talks about how our outer world comes from our inner world. We are so attached and so human-centered that we think that there's nothing outside ourselves. Even like the little moral story of the goose. If you don't know what a goose is, it's like those big dogs. The dogs who have the big neck, right? So that's a goose. So the history of this goose says that he was always laying a gold egg, right? And his owners look at him and they said, well, probably he has more eggs inside. Why is he laying just one egg? We want more eggs. So they decided and they killed the goose. And when they opened the goose, they noticed the goose had just one regular egg. The same with scientists. They try to find the soul by opening the human's body and trying to look for it. The same could be said with this amazing paradox I'm gonna tell you right now. The paradox of your own face. It is impossible that a human can see its own face unless it uses a mirror. But the mere fact of using a mirror, when you see your face backwards. So you're not seeing your face at all. You're seeing a reflection of your face. And that's not your face. So humans have tried to avoid living in the world by surrounding itself with all pleasures, with all material possessions, with having people around them, with having all these things that make you feel complete. But at the very end, it makes you just feel unaware of what's going on around you and unhappy. So my question for you today is, what brings happiness to your life? What makes you feel happy? Even if it disappears, you know you're not going to be sad. But the moment it's in front of you right now, you're enjoying it. Except for example, my mom brings me happiness. I am happy with my mom. I enjoy every single moment I have with my mom. I love taking care of her. And I love when we talk. However, I know the moment she's not here anymore, my happiness does not depend upon her. My happiness is just a way of expressing myself through her. My question for you is, who brings you happiness? And why does that person or thing brings you happiness? Send your video and see you in the next chapter.